That's okay. Okay, this is Jody Stone on the 20th of April, 1989. This is going to be a series of interviews about Maurice Ferrucci and the Housatonic Bookshop. The first person to go with this is Mike McCabe, who is here with me now. And Mike, we need to find out who you are first. Were you born in town?
No, I was born in New York City, but we moved here in 47, and so I grew up in Salisbury.
Who were your parents?
Elsie McCabe and Spalding McCabe.
So your name isn't Mike?
My name is Spalding McCabe Jr.
Where did Mike come from?
Mike is a name my mother gave me when I was born. Dad was overseas in the war, and it was a nickname my mother gave me, and just always
stuck.
Yeah.
So you grew, did you go to school here?
Went to school here, Town Hill, yep. Indian Mountain.
Then what?
Then I went to Gunnery, mm-hmm. and then Hamilton School, Hamilton College.
Yeah. How did you come to work for Maurice?
Well, it is an interesting story. I came back for a weekend to visit my parents in 1969. Maurice had just had a heart attack. My mother met Betty Ferrucci at a cocktail party and asked after Maurice. She said Maurice was in the hospital, and the doctor said he had to get someone to work for him. He couldn't do it alone anymore. And so that Sunday, that Monday, I guess, I went down to talk to him. And almost reluctantly, he decided that, well, he'd try me 2 days a week. I was to come in Tuesdays and Thursdays, essentially, to get the mail. And he decided that was all that was needed. And eventually that worked out, and I stayed for, well, almost 6 years.
Were you in, you'd finished college?
I had finished college, yes.
Okay.
And I was working actually in a bookstore and a book distribution house, two jobs in Boston at the time. And I decided that this would be better. It was essentially an apprenticeship, which is rare these days. You can work in a Doubleday's or Brentano's or Scribner's, but to find a bookstore like Maurice's and get to work there for 5 years is almost impossible because the shop just didn't exist.
What was so special about his?
Well, of course, the person was exceptional. His stock was exceptional. He read so much. More than any other book dealer I've met, he knew his books. He knew what he had. And you could talk about him, he could talk about schools of thought, philosophy, and specific books that he had just finished the night before. He was amazing that way. He made you feel exceptional because you asked about a certain book, and he had read it, usually, and could talk about it, so that made you feel better. There's nothing in a bookstore like being at least aware of the customer's request. If you haven't heard of the book, the customer goes away sort of a dumb chase. They begin to think maybe the book was this, but if at least the proprietor says, oh yes, I know the book, you may not have it, but if you know the book, the customer feels encouraged and continues. Maurice had read for years and years. Taught history at Salisbury, but it seemed English and literature and philosophy seemed to me his stronger subjects. I don't know what he majored at Yale, but his first bookstore was in the 20s in Harvard Square, and he was, I guess, not just an up-and-coming bookseller. People recognized him immediately as extraordinary. And he had friends, Conrad Aiken, T.S. Eliot, Felix Frankfurter, Henry Murray, people who went through Harvard or MIT at that point. Robert Frost was a great friend of Maurice's. He had many famous friends, designers of books, poets, novelists, writers of all sorts. And although I started working for him in 69, he still got letters from all these people, those who were alive. Elliot had died, but Conrad Aiken, McLeish, Frankfurter had died. But I saw letters that he had received. So early on, he had exceptional taste, great taste, quality of books was must have been extraordinary in the shop in Department Square. There's always been a mystery as to why he really moved from Harvard Square to Salisbury. I've heard two or three different stories. I don't know what is true. The one I've heard the most is that the federal agents got wind that he was selling 1930, it would have been Lady Chatterley's Lover, under the counter. And maybe Ulysses, James Joyce's Ulysses, and maybe some others. And they had the goods on them, and the story that I've heard the most is they made a deal. You get out of town and we won't pinch you, basically. And whether that's true or not, I don't know. Anyway, he wound up here. His second wife was from Salisbury. And in 1929, he asked Phil Warner, who had a bookstore here, would it be okay if he came into town and started up a bookshop? And Phil said, with my blessing, Phil wanted to start up a woodworking shop. And so it was perfect. It worked out really well. Marie started, and it was slow for years and years and years. And he told me about how he could literally teach in the 30s. It was later than that, but he taught at Salisbury. But he could teach a full full course at Salisbury and run his bookstore, all the correspondence, and with no one else. He did it all. Then in the 50s, late 50s, Barbara Constantine worked for him for a long time. But he did it all. And he put out catalogs in the 30s. He put out almost 7 or 8 different wonderful catalogs. Great books. He always insisted, he had high prices, he always insisted on meticulous condition, had to be great condition. And dust jacket, he was very meticulous in his describing of a particular book. He was certainly an old school bookseller. You don't find many like him. The old school, if you had a customer, he was your customer and you were his bookseller. And whatever you want, if you didn't get, you certainly tried to get. And if someone wanted a library, you would in time produce a whole library for this person. And there was a loyalty back and forth. Now that doesn't work. Every major collector has 10 different booksellers they get books from. And it's understood now. But back then, he was the old school as far as introducing people in his shop. He never, if two people should get to know one another, had similar interests, he wouldn't introduce them because they came to see him. They didn't come to see other people. They came to see him as Roland Fitzgerald. And I would be there working, and I just knew two people would love to know each other, but not in Maurice's shop, not on his time. And outside, that was fine. But he was that way. I have picked up some things from him, not that, but there are other things that the old world, I appreciate. And having worked for someone like that, he was an anachronism in many ways, because he was in the country. He had very little idea of what was going on in the cities, what was the current prices, what was being collected, who were forming the major collections. And he was an entity unto himself. He didn't really appreciate other dealers coming to him. He would mean he'd have to give a discount, and he was reluctant to give discounts. He had enough good, wealthy customers, so if someone wanted to come in and get a discount, always grudgingly. And dealers picked up on that fairly quickly. Question me, what about Bruce? I think it's fine. In the very end, he saw it, and then he did let the others come in, and it was very well. I know Hugh McMillan and Jerry Bowen tried to get him to do a catalog, and he was working on it, but his heart wasn't in it. It would have been a fantastic catalog. All the things he had worked on. He died before really much was. I mean, Jerry would have done the typing, and Hugh would have helped him. And I had left in 74, 75, and this was probably 1977 that they sort of hatched the idea. Jerry would have done something. But it was a great idea. They should have. And they were trying to straighten up his life. Hugh wanted to make a better will, and Jerry wanted to do a catalog. It would have been a fantastic swan song to go off having produced a catalog, which would have included the books that he had. He had books upstairs in his drawers with socks and underpants underneath for Eliot signed first editions. They were under his bed in all shelves. The bookseller who was called in to orchestrate the sale of the books had no idea how many books there were or what quality. You could walk into a room and see the number of books, but the sort of books that were hidden away, no one. I doubt if Maurice knew where he had all these things. So as they were cleaning out underpants and shirts, there would be 42, could be early Hemingways, could be Fitzgeralds, who knows? And earlier. His poet friends like MacLeish, Aiken, Eliot, Yeats, he had met Yeats several times, twice when Yeats was over here at Yale. And one of his great evenings was an evening with Yeats when he first came over to Yale. This would have been 1914 or 15. Yeats had not been that well known. And Yale invited him to come over, which he did. Maurice was in charge of the program, the bringing in of poets program. And Maurice said that the evening of the reading produced something like six other students. They were in a huge hall at Yale. There Yeats was way up there at the podium. Maurice and four, five, six people way away. So Yeats said this is ridiculous. He got off his podium, he came down, he formed a little table, sort of like this. They sat around, they talked poetry for maybe 2 hours. He read what he wanted to read, and then it was obviously serious people who had read some, probably a couple of professors, four or five teachers, where he said he never spent an evening like it. It was just fantastic. Yeats came back his senior year, and you couldn't get a standing room position at all. Thousands of people, and he had then been discovered. So the first time, Maurice said it was certainly memorable. One of the things he did in this town, which I would have loved to have seen, and I don't know what the dates were, but the acting, the Salisbury Players. And you have to ask someone else about that, but I bet those were wonderful.
Jack Fisher talked about it in an interview in Hulu, and there was a rather famous female actor who lived in Lakeville. It was named Vincent Rang a Bell with me, and they must have been some plays.
They must have been wonderful productions.
Yeah.
They had, my mother and father remember them a little bit in the early 50s. I don't know when they faded out. So the Salisbury Players. Mm-hmm. I think right here in the town hall. Oh, the old stage.
I think so. Yeah. The old stage. Yeah.
Yeah, and he was very active in historical, anything to do with any publication or any printing. He was always willing to give his time for that, make sure it was well printed and well designed, well set up. The book on Salisbury, the Petit's book, he organized that. I think that thing right there, the historical landmarks of Salisbury, I think he did that. He did a lot of publications and printings. Again, always very well done. But as a bookseller, I've never been in a bookstore that is similar to his, both here and in England. I suspect there might be One man in town, very knowledgeable on bookstores, who's now head of the Harvard University Press, Arthur Rosenthal, he said there was one other bookstore in the country similar to Maurice's, and that, I think he said, it was either in Cleveland or Chicago. I can't remember, but he said there was one other shop like Maurice's in the country. And this would have been in the 60s and the 70s. Maurice had new books, he had old books, he had antiquarian books, he had books printed in the 1500s. He knew them, he knew what he had, he knew what was the contents. And just about every book, he was a gourmet cook, he knew herbs, he had a wonderful selection of herb books and gardening books. His children's books were classic. By that I mean they were the standard. That was, if there were a weak link, and it wouldn't be by my judgment, it would be by someone else's judgment, it would probably be the children's books, because he didn't buy in a lot of the new books as they came out. But all the standard, classic children's books skills had. Then he did in his heydays, when he was really making money, and everything was going smoothly, it was probably the 60s. He had a lot of wealthy people who were buying a lot of books. He did really well. The cost of, for instance, the cost of binding books was still low. And he would have many books bound, children's illustrated books, for instance. He had bound up, and they always sold very well for Christmas. Like that. He did a lot of binding, and that always enhanced a book, either the binding or put it in a slipcase. So he had all sorts of angles that he played, as well as straightforward. I remember one woman came in and she wanted the first edition of Edna St. Vincent Millay's Renaissance. And Maurice had it, produced it, and she bought it. And she was absolutely delighted. And some months later she came in and he asked how the book was. Oh, she said she took it to bed with her every night, just read it. And Maurice just paled, because to him, first edition, you don't take it to bed. You buy a second-hand hardcover, you can take that to bed. And he could just see this. It was a delicate book rolling over on him, or falling asleep, or whatever he envisioned. He was horrified. And so the books, to my way of thinking and thinking about them, books were the most important thing. He had five wives, and I think that the reason the wives seemed to come and go, he had this singular passion for books, and to the exclusion of, he didn't lose male friendships. He made male friendships, and they lasted his entire life. But with women, I think the books got in the way. And when it came to making a choice, he stuck with the book.
That's interesting. I never thought about that. In all those years, I saw him with various wives.
Yeah, I think it was the books. That was his real love. And one of the, until he got older, when I started there in 69, he was probably 75 or 73, something like that. And except for his eyes, he was in pretty good health. He did have a heart attack, but one of the minor frictions that we had, and that lasted until he got old enough so he really couldn't get about as often as he did, was unwrapping books that came in the morning. And he loved books so much, he didn't even want me unwrapping. He wanted to be the first person to see what it was. He didn't want me to have a thrill. And it is a thrill. If you love books that way, it is a thrill, because you don't order a lot of garbage, you order good books. So almost everything that comes in is going to be exciting. Could be something that you have already sold, which is good for business. Could be something from England. Could be something from a out of print dealer, some rare book, or something he just wanted himself. But he begrudgingly allowed me to begin to unwrap things, maybe my second year. And there are some, that anything that looks like it came from a dealer, an old book dealer, he'd handle those. Something came from a publisher, a new one, I could have those. But that, looking back on it, you could tell that I worked in other bookshops in Boston. I've been in a lot of bookstores in Washington. I lived in D.C. But no one had that. I have it, and there are obviously other people do. But the idea of being concerned who unwraps the books in the morning, the most bookstores think that's sort of ridiculous. I'm going to extreme. But Reese, he definitely had it. And he passed that on to me. It's one of the highlights of the day, for sure. Especially if you know you're going to use the package, it's finally there. Maybe you unwrap it mid-morning from Gickle right away. You play that same game.
Kind of save it for a cup of coffee
absolutely.
And a break.
Oh, absolutely.
A Christmas treat.
Yeah. And I would get him talking as much as I could about his days in well, Harvard Square. I didn't want to find personal life what went on before.
What was his shop called?
It was called Dunster House Bookshop. And I actually have the sign that hung outside the Dunster House Bookshop. I bought it through a dealer who, I got it from a dealer who knew what it was, a local dealer, antique dealer. And he bought it from someone who just thought it was a sign, didn't know anything who Dunster House was or where it was. But this, and I have pictures of Maurice's shop. I have a linoleum cut done by an artist that Maurice knew. I have a linoleum cut and a couple of photographs. So it lines up. It is indeed, and there was one sign. It was a picture on both sides of Dante. Yes, it was Dante. Because Maurice read Dante every year, and read Dante every year, Moby Dick every year, and there was something else he read every single year for years. 30 or 40 years, every year, he would definitely read those. And then the other one. But it was Dante, Moby Dick, one other, who was a classic, Greek or Roman, and I can't remember what it was. Anyway, if the sign was people knowing him in the 60s, 70s, 80s, maybe they would think having a sign with Dante on it in the 30s didn't make any sense. But back then, I guess he was passionate. He had a hole in his living room. He had a hole, probably a 3 foot wide shelf, floor to ceiling, nothing but Dante. Different translations, critical commentaries, books, biographies on Dante. And he had a great friend in Cambridge, this man Henry Murray, who was a psychologist, a teacher at Harvard, who was passionate about Melville. And Dante, and they were, just, you know, I was lucky enough to meet Dr. Murray, who just died a couple of years ago, that he was able to heal, and was an eminent man in this world of science. But he would come for weekends. This would be in the late 60s, I remember, for example. And two subjects always discussed were one's new Dante and one's new Melville, that would be one of the picked up his feet about once a year. So he still had that classical education and passion for Greek and Roman books, Dante, Melville, Moby Dick probably was his favorite. When he died, he had Montaigne. But in his bedroom, there was one like when there came to get a book towards the end of it, because he sold off some of his personal books. And I was in there just long enough for a quick look around him. But he kept his Melville there, he kept some Hawthorne, and some documents there, the books that he would revert back to every night, whenever he felt like it. But one of my great dreams is traveling in this country or, say, England, and just going to a town, checking into a hotel or something, and then walking down the street and finding a bookstore. Have it be like a bookstore. I haven't found it yet, but I'm sure someday I will. And because I can remember people coming from the White House. They were staying at the White House as a student, and a child of the year, or school, or whatever it is. And they literally would just sort of blunder in. There's a bookstore, let's go see what it is. They might be looking for cards, but every once in a while, you would get someone who clearly loved books, and you could just get gags and look around, and they'd never see anyone. They're just, and they would always buy, and they would be customers for life. They just, you know, they just walk out of the bar, sort of, in the White Hart, into the bookstore, and they never see anyone. And they, you could hear them, you know, the husband and wife. One of them would say, well, look at these books, can people believe them? And yeah, out in the middle of nowhere, it's all very competitive. And people who knew the shop would say the same thing, but coming across it blind, it was a revelation. It's something that I hope will come across myself.
It wasn't very big, you know, when you think about it.
No.
A lot of the books you'd ask for, he would disappear. And obviously now you're telling me they were in the bedroom or
the living room, or in the drawer. Catacombs, really. He didn't have many really good books in the cellar, but he had three little rooms just in back of his office. Cubby books, really, what they were. And then you'd walk through the kitchen, and you'd go down, you'd have one room where all the cookbooks were, you'd walk down where all the paperbacks were, and then there was a last room where wrapping was done, and natural history, all paperbacks, general, but new, everything new. But he could always afford to keep things. Sometimes he didn't realize what he had, I'm sure. But the things that didn't sell, he of course had great taste, so whatever he bought was good. And it's sort of like old saw in the book, maybe other books too. But something good, a good book will always sell. A bestseller is going to sell very quickly, but in 6 months it's gone, like a year. A good book will sell. You may have to wait a year. And the way inflation goes, you may lose money after it if you keep it at that price. But it will sell. And he had enough money to, he never had a sale. He had one sale after I left him. I'd say in maybe 75 or 76. And he knocked off books, I think, something like 20%. And 20%, you're not going to sell anything, really. And he didn't. And Gail Vincent, who was working for him at the time, said that his comment was, yeah, see, you can't sell anything in a sale. It's ridiculous to have a sale. He had a sales section where he put books that he wanted at half price. But if you have a sale, you have to sort of let your general stock be at the mercy of buyers and dealers and the culture. So he kept them at bay by keeping the discount price to 20%. It's wonderful. And then say, see, I should have had a sale.
Mike, the house, excuse me, the house that it was in, did he buy that? Was that
No, he bought that.
A Scoville house?
He bought that in 1930. He bought that in 30. He came down here, I think, in 29. Quit his bookstore in Harvard Square in 29. He came down here in 29. And in, I think, 1930, he bought that house. And it didn't have the wing that was sort of the entertaining. Mm-hmm. That was actually a doctor's one or two room house. It was off a little bit. It's on the old maps, mm-hmm. and it was on his property, so he fused the two together. It's not a two-story structure, it's just the mm-hmm. And I think he might have done one or two smaller buildings in the back where they sort of telescope mm-hmm. out. He might have added one or two, so it was a smaller structure. And the shop of the basic house, the shop, took up maybe half, and then upstairs he had, if there were six rooms, at least three of them were filled with books. One I was not allowed to go into, that was his poetry and his erotic literature. He had a lot of that, and in the old days, the 30s, 40s, and 50s, a lot of it was illegal. Now, you can buy anything at sell your paint. Just about anything. But then, and he must have got stumped, this idea that he had to move out of Harvard Square because the feds came down on him, might have credence, because I know anytime something that came in that was the slightest bit salacious or too erotic, it would go right back, and he would look at it, and maybe it would come back out, or maybe it would go upstairs. But he was very sensitive about that. And he, so I think he might have been just a product of his upbringing, sort of, and the early days of book selling, there were books that you could get arrested for, so, which is, you don't get arrested for anything now. But you could in the 30s, and so there was this one room upstairs that was mostly poetry, but maybe a third of it was old early Henry Miller books, and no classic erotic literature. By that I mean from, say, 1900 on back. It was current, but anything questionable would go up there, and he'd ask about it, sure, but he would not advertise. He wouldn't put it out in the shop, and he was quite a stickler for that.
I think you have a point that maybe he was stung. He was being very careful.
Yeah. I've asked, there's an old bookseller up in Harvard Square, my name is Star, and Star remembers Maria. Star started business about the same time. This was, I was living in Boston in the early 60s. I asked him, and that's what he remembered, that Maurice was selling all sorts of things that he shouldn't have. I guess he did it for a while, and one guy kept coming in asking for things to tell each other, his mother didn't have it. He would buy other things, and eventually, I guess Marie sold them one. Right away, they had it with something. But he would he'd bring things in from England, he had contacts in England. So his sources were wonderful, all over him. He'd have booksellers, and he was really active in the 30s, and I think he set his reputation in the 30s. Then he went off to the country, in the 20s, mm-hmm. when he was in Harvard Square. Then he went to the country in the 30s and just quieted down and never really got in the swim of things. So he could have. He could have put out many more catalogs, done shows, things like that. But he was he sort of retired from what you would call a big city active bookseller. And I think I mentioned to you, I would go to New York City in the 60s and talk to, again, old-time booksellers. Maggie Cohn was one, and Danny Deusman. And they would all say, oh, yeah, whatever the hell happened to Maurice Spruski? Is he still up there? He's still selling his books? He's still doing okay? Because at one point, he was, I guess, one of the best. Everyone knew it. And then just off to the country went. And it wasn't in the early days. I guess he obviously had some money of his own, but I'm sure in the 30s, for instance, he didn't earn a lot of money in the bookstore. He put out some very interesting catalogs. But if he wanted to earn money, he wouldn't have been in Salisbury, Connecticut, although his wife did. His second wife, I think, came from Salisbury. Second, third, fourth. But I think second did too. But he had essentially dropped out, and these booksellers who were contemporaries of his, and they're all dead now. If they hadn't dealt with him, they had heard about him. What a wonderful shop, great stock. And they'd always ask me, you know, is he selling the stuff? If I go up there, if I give him a call, I'd always have to say honestly that I would doubt it. It would be hard. You'd have to really talk your way in. And very few dealers did. He had his pet customers, and towards the end in the 70s, he would actually call you up and tempt you with things, which he really wouldn't before. He would wait till you came in. He would write letters occasionally, of course. But I think he must have known he wasn't going to get out this catalog. It was just too much. And catalog, if you really love your books, a catalog is can be an agony, because most of your catalog is probably going to be sold to dealers. who some care about the book, some don't. But what they care about is getting the book, and they're going to sell it and make more money. And Reese always wanted to place the book in a home or in someone's library. That was again the old time bookseller that was in him. He liked making money, but he would rather have it go to someone who deserved the book and would keep it in the library. And so the idea of selling it just to a dealer who would then make more money, ooh, that's greater. And so I think that partially was the reason that he didn't move very quickly on the catalog. But I know four or five people said they got this one phone call from Maurice. He called himself the Tempter. This is the Tempter. Maybe right away. And he had some fantastic book that he thought they might like, and he always, this was about 75, 76, 77, 78, before he died those years. He'd give them good deals, good prices. Just thought, you know, you should have the book. That was quite often what he would say, you should have the book. And he was probably always right. And some people could afford it, but you know, they couldn't, and he set up, you know, some sort of arrangement where you could buy a time or something like that. But that was his approach towards the end of selling some of his really fine, both individual books and then sets of books. Wasn't very nice sense from the ways which he had. And they were in his own books, you know, also. They were his books, not ones that were in the store. Because they were sort of open to the public. But it was a treat to be able to really apprentice, the old world term of apprentice, in a shop like that is almost, I was going to say unique. It's probably not unique, but it certainly happens very rarely, say from 1950 on, where you have a bookstore like that, that will take in someone and basically train. Maurice's and my arrangement always was, I could never have the name of the shop, I could never have the location of the shop, and if he died and I was still working for him, I could buy the books. And I left early to start up my own shop. He was going to slow down, and I wanted to speed up, basically. And he let me buy a lot of wonderful books at a very good price, too. So he definitely helped me out. But what happened in Harvard Square, he never forgot. He sold his, it's another thing, maybe, until he got out of the herd, he sold his shop to a man who initially, I guess, was fine, at least made him the money. And he ran it in the ground. In about 5 years, it was gone. And people, and he still had a lot of friends in Harvard Square, and they said, Maurice, you should see your shop. And she said, oh, and boy, that just killed. Because he sold them the stock, he sold them the charge accounts, he sold them the sign, he sold them everything. Customers, the worst. And within probably less than 5 years, the man, I think eventually drank himself to death, and the whole thing just tumbled. But, oh, Maurice, that was a great thorn in his side. So he decided early on, I guess, that that's never going to happen to him again. So almost within the first year that I worked there, he said, you know, you're never going to get the name. He said he was going to be buried with the sign. I don't know where he was. Yeah, but never the location, and never the name. Those was not going to run the risk of having it besmirched or confused. Because no matter, even if you're a good bookseller, your shop is going to be different from someone else's good bookseller. And he knew that, but he just wasn't going to take the risk. And that turned out, I mean, that was, a lot of people in town would say that. Well, some people in town thought it was sort of unfair for Maurice to not sell me more names, or even, I mean, more books, or even sell me the name. And I certainly understood, because I'm in the same position now, really, as I will be in another 15 or 20 years, of having something you built yourself, and then, the idea of selling the whole thing. But he was not in the same town, he wasn't in Harvard Square, but he had a lot of money. So we get these reports, progress reports, the lack of progress reports. And so that was a, that was a great, great bit. But the idea of working with someone like that, he did not talk freely about books. You had to get him going. And I was interested in the books, but I was always interested, also interested in the book business, how it was practiced at 30 and 40. And days that were busy, he didn't like talking too much on his own time. If he was paying me, he didn't want to be telling me hour after hour. So, but in the course of 5 years, I got a lot of great stories and how personal it really was back then in the 30s and the 40s. And he knew all the presidents of all the publishing firms. He ordered books, he sold a lot of books, but they respected him as a knowledgeable bookseller. And if they needed a comment on a book, they called him himself. And he said, in a way, he outlived his time. Maybe he should have died in the 70s. The 70s, things started to get computerized. Because in the, say, 50s, if something, say, Random House sent a wrong order, he'd just call it and he'd get caught for it and lose the president. And he'd take on something half done, say, no problem, just send it right back. Just send it back and we'll get the other order out today. And you just couldn't do that now. He'd try in the 60s to call his old friends, some died. Some were so protected by secretaries and computers and these new fulfillment, Department of Fulfillment, which had never been applied to the bookstore trade at all. But suddenly in the 70s, there came this Department of Fulfillment. And if you had a complaint, you had to deal with them. You couldn't just, well, it makes sense. You couldn't call the president of Random House in the 70s if they sent a damaged book. But in the 30s and 40s, you could. And he remembers those wonderful days when it was a joy to run a bookstore. And now there is certainly joy, but there are tremendous headaches. Back then, he said there were really almost no headaches. The way he ran a bookstore, he said there were almost no headaches. Or if there were, you made it yourself by doing something silly. But you didn't get 5 messed up orders a week. You had to write a letter and return at your own expense, or write another letter saying, I want mine at $2.10 for returning. You didn't have to do any of that stuff. It was a gentlemanly trade. There's still gentlemen in the trade, but they're so isolated from running the actual business that